All right. Well, welcome to this bonus episode of Historium. Today, I am joined with story editor Thomas. Thomas, how you doing?
Hey, what's up? I'm doing great.
Howdy, howdy. And also our official Historium baseball correspondent, Dallas Dickinson. Dallas, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. Yeah, excited for my annual appearance as the Historium sports related correspondent to add what I can.
So today we are talking about. So this episode has bounced around in my brain almost like since Historium started, and I'm just trying to find the best way to tell the story. And I finally figured out, like, I think having you two here, I think would be much better for this particular chaotic story. So I cannot wait to get into it. So basically, this is a story in five parts. Okay, so I'll go part one, part two, in the order that numbers go. So,
is it about baseball or is it about disco?
Oh, you're going to find out. And the answer to that is both. Part one, disco. So, first off, what is your all's relation to disco? What when you think of disco, like, what comes to mind?
For me, it's just like, it's like a very specific aesthetic, like clothing wise, appearance wise. It's like flared pants, you know, like very large collars, and everyone's doing the hand with the pointer finger up, like down and up, like it's very basic.
Is that called the lawnmower? I think I can't remember what that was.
Yeah, very basic understanding. I hear a lot of like guitars that are doing like the waka waka thing, a lot of that.
Yep. What about you, Thomas?
I just picture a sort of depressed and downtrodden cop with amnesia trekking around a sort of fictionalized version of a stone.
Right.
So for the folks who don't know, that was a reference to one of my favorite video games of all time, Disco Elysium. Go play it right now.
Very good.
After this episode.
But actually very, very little. Like, similar to what Dallas said, kind of just like the disco
the
emoji on the phone.
He is doing that in the emoji. That's hilarious. Disco is something I feel like it's kind of resurgent amongst the Zoomers. I think there is kind of like a disco renaissance. And the styles are returning, and I don't know, love the cycles. It seems like we're on an upswing of disco. But basically, disco, the name comes from discotheque or discoteca, depending on if it's French or Spanish. And so that is a derivative of bibliothèque, which is the French word for library. So it basically means a library of phonographic records. And the first use of a discotheque, like the first widespread use of the word discotheque, was I didn't know this until looking it up for this episode, researching for this episode, but the first use was in Paris during the Nazi occupation, where where groups would gather in underground spaces, sometimes literal bunkers or bomb shelters, to play records together. And so I had no idea, like it's that's kind of where the term at least popularized. People have been dancing in rooms for as long as there has been music in rooms. But that's kind of where the term comes from.
But it started out as like a secret underground.
Yeah, I think like thing. A lot of it was, I didn't do crazy research into that specifically, but a lot of it, from what I saw, had to do with the volume, how it's much easier to turn the volume down on a record player or to stop cranking it, maybe even in that time. Than it is to tell a live band to shut up.
Oh, right.
Okay.
And of course, a lot of, the actual like French resistance was literally underground in a lot of places. So has that origin there. But basically it kind of is this term that's kind of on the fringes. There's a little bit of disco stuff that pops up. But it wasn't until mostly the early 60s when discotheques start to bloom in urban areas in the United States. The two main hubs of it were New York City and Philadelphia. And so they just exploded in popularity. So they started in late 50s, early 60s, exploded in the late 60s. These discotheques, which is shortened to disco, pushed boundaries because like before disco, most dancing in the United States was a dancer and their partner, right? It was like something you did with your sweetheart. Like even in some forms of dancing, like square dancing, line dancing, you may switch partners, but at the end of the day, it's usually one man, one woman executing a predetermined series of dance steps. And disco kind of bucked that trend in almost every way. It was much more free form. It was much more you're tight, packed in. A lot of these discotheques were literally underground. And so, you know, when you're in like a big open above ground space, you can kind of spread out to the fences or wherever. It can kind of spread freely, but in a tight box, you know, underground, you can kind of be packed in like sardines. So it's a lot of like, you know, close enough that you can touch, like there's just electricity in the air. You're packed in there. But yeah, it broke conformity in so many different ways. Like coloring outside the lines is the cliche, but you know, it's weird because it has this kind of breaking from conformity. At the same time, it has this rigid backbone of like hypnotic drumbeat rhythm that almost like forces you to dance. Like Time Magazine ran an article when disco was exploding, and it first described it as diabolical thump and shriek.
I'm in.
Which is kind of awesome. Like diabolical thump and shriek.
Was this the origin just of clubs then?
Pretty much, yeah.
Like as we know them.
There's always
today.
Been, and of course, with genres in general, there's no hard boundaries and everything blends into each other. There were like dance halls and stuff. But there was something distinctly different about disco. And a lot of that had to do with the people participating. They tended to be urban folks. So black people, brown people, what Time Magazine in that same article describes as flamboyant, ne'er-do-wells, you know, leftist, queer people, the marginalia of society. And so like when the local dance halls, think like late 1950s, like, you know, think of that kind of local dance hall. If they wouldn't appreciate your presence, you go underground, and like a lot of times literally underground to like the dance clubs, like under huge buildings in urban centers. Yeah, even like back then, like the vast majority of disco artists were either black, brown, or queer. And so at the time of the big event that takes place that we will get to in a moment, Stonewall, the Stonewall riots, if you're familiar with those, might do an episode on those one day. That was actually like a year prior. So it's like right in the heart of this movement, of this tension. So by the time we get all the way to the late 70s, where the bulk of our story actually takes place, disco was dominating, right? Have you all seen Saturday Night Fever?
I haven't, no.
I have not either.
He's very good, yeah.
He's the best.
Hey, man, he's great. He's the king out there.
John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever.
It's a very, like, pro-disco movie, but it goes out of its way to make sure that the audience knows that John Travolta is straight. They make sure you know that, right? Even though he's dressed in a flamboyant way, they make sure, like, the audience is beaten over the head with the fact that he is not a gay man. One of the articles I read described Saturday Night Fever as taking disco out of the closet, which is already like gross the way they framed that. But like, it really did do that. And Saturday Night Fever, like
in terms of like making it more straight or in terms of like outing it?
No, it's making it really what Saturday Night Fever did was make it mainstream. Right.
It sounds like a co-opting effort at the very most. Yeah.
Yes, because the main thing that that happened around this time is that record labels were looking at the charts, and they were seeing these things shooting up the charts that did not have a label. They were like indie stuff. What in the world? And they like almost had to like find, like it was hard to hunt down like a phone number to get in contact with like, you know, this random Puerto Rican immigrant in New York and try to be like, hey, man, do you want to join this record label or whatever? So it started off as kind of an indie thing. But then by the time of the late 70s, it became kind of this this powerhouse machine in the music industry. And so by the late 70s, you know, like I said, Saturday Night Fever, the Village People were all over. They were on magazine covers and ads. Disco nearly swept the 1979 Grammys, which people were some people were upset about. So that's where disco is at in 1979. Part 2, Steve Dahl. And it's not, unfortunately, it's not D-O-L-L. It's D-A-H-L.
I like that more. I don't know why.
Oh, really?
Okay. It's like bear paint, Steve. You know, when there's like a sneaky H in there, you know, like, it feels, yeah.
You Germans, you sneaky. All right, so Steve Dahl. Steve Dahl is kind of the main character of our story. So Steve Dahl grew up in Los Angeles. Have you guys heard of that place?
Yeah, big fan, lives there.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I live there too. I'm less big fan, but also heard of it, yes. Also familiar with the idea.
I was begrudgingly living in concept. Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Oh, starlets across the Midwest are flocking to Los Angeles, but you're begrudgingly taking up an apartment there, Dallas?
I think I'm just still bitter because I have lived like in the general area for like the general area for college, kind of like close enough. And then also now, and I still have yet to like come across someone famous. So I think I'm just like bitter about that. Yeah, it's really because I chose to live somewhere that is far enough outside of Los Angeles where people
don't actually have to parallel park.
Yeah, people don't actually like live here, like famous people. But I feel like I go into, you know, Highland Park and Silver Lake enough to where I should have seen someone by now. But I think I have just sort of this like 60-foot repellent where it's like they can't penetrate a bubble that I've set around myself or something. Like, they try to come to the coffee shop I'm at, and they just get, like, bounced out by something.
Someone's there.
So wait, I have a bad feeling about this. I know this is a tangent, but do you mean zero total celebrity sightings in your time in Los Angeles?
I haven't seen anybody, like, on the street, nothing. Like, in the store.
I cannot believe that.
I feel like I just need to go, like, work from Erewhon.
Brad Pitt comes up to you and is like, hey, man, you dropped this.
I've literally seen you're like, Brad Pitt. Thanks, man.
That's God. Crazy.
That's gnarly. Insane.
And Angelina Jolie. Like, wait. So, okay. You're just going to the wrong Trader Joe's, man.
No, maybe you guys have exact different vibes where his is like repellent and yours is like shark bait for them.
Yeah, that's probably it. I give off, like I've often said, like, you know, if you're a celebrity, that's a red flag for me just as a person. So I feel like they pick up on that and they just can't. Yeah, they can't penetrate any area that I'm in. Yeah, like I go to the UCB a lot. Like eventually I'll have met famous people, maybe like one or two.
You just got to become one. You know, that's we're on different trajectories. You know, I'm never going to become famous. But like Dallas, I think you got it in you.
Well, I'm starting here, so we'll see.
Fortunately for you guys, a lot of the story doesn't take place in Los Angeles, but that is where Steve Dahl grew up. So he started volunteering freshman year of high school at a local radio station. Very soon thereafter, dropped out of high school without telling his parents and started working full time at the radio station and basically never looked back.
Okay.
So as he started, he was on air. Like he was charismatic enough that he got on air, but he was never allowed in like the top time slots. Like, first off, because he was like 18, but second off, because like one radio executive said he didn't have the voice for it. His voice is a little higher pitched than most like kind of deep radio announcers. And it is a little, it's hard to describe. Having listened to several hours of his stuff, it has kind of a cranky vibe to it. It's not bad. It's not grating, but it is kind of like a... It's insane that he had that much crankiness in an 18-year-old.
Like he's just a hater?
Just kind of a hater, but like just kind of has a curmudgeonly, fun kind of a charismatic complainer is what I would call it.
Oh my God, he's just like me.
So at age 18, as he is working at this radio station, a woman called in and requested a song, the song Suzanne by Leonard Cohen.
You can trust her, for she's touched your perfect body with her mind.
Steve Dahl, over this call, immediately fell in love with this woman. And somehow, shortly thereafter, they get married. He marries this random caller at 18.
Do you know anything about how they actually met?
Exactly. I couldn't figure out, like, I don't know if he, I didn't have the actual audio of her requesting it, or of, like, him maybe, like, asking her on a date on air, but he was always doing bits like that, and this one weirdly worked out, like, they were actually married.
That's the sort of thing that only happens in, like, 90s rom-coms with Meg Ryan,
I know.
That warms my heart to know that that's real.
Yeah, that sometimes that actually happens. So obviously, the relationship did not work out. It lasted less than a year.
My heart is once again cold.
Yeah. Man, yeah. Brutal. Bummer. Yeah. In effect, it's getting more relatable at this point, I think. A certain grade.
So Steve recalled about the marriage. He did this on air, that he admitted he probably should have paid more attention to that Leonard Cohen song before marrying her. And Thomas, if you know the song, it is like a pretty, like, it doesn't make any sense as a song to like.
I'm looking at the lyrics now.
Yeah, dude, it's like a bad relationship. It's not like a.
Right, wow, there's a lot. I thought I sort of knew this song, but there's a lot more going on in here than I initially realized.
Yeah.
Suzanne's screaming, begging him to stop, but he won't stop. He don't stop. Not till she stops struggling. She's lying on the floor in a pool full of blood. He goes in the other room to get something.
Good God.
Wow.
So yeah, him joking like, yeah, maybe I should have listened to the actual song. So Dahl was heartbroken. So basically his ex-wife is dating this radio exec in Los Angeles, and he is desperately heartbroken. But she recommends him this job as a morning show host at a radio station in Detroit. Now, I don't know whether she did this to out of the kindness of her heart or to get this weird guy out of this weird, like at this point, I think 19-year-old out of her hair.
Never marry a teen. That would be my advice to her.
Yeah.
Pretty good advice. But basically Dahl applied. And like I said, despite being like 19 at the time, he got the job. And so he had his little morning show on a pretty small radio station in Detroit. But over the course of the year, he was pretty good. He was pretty funny, pretty charismatic. People liked him. He did some kind of, he would do things on air that were a little like risky. He would like push the boundaries a little bit. And so soon he had a 7.2% market share in Detroit, which is pretty good. Like that's what the radio guys, that's what they care about is market share.
Can you tell me exactly what that means? Like, is that the like amount of time that he's on air or just like when they're doing polls of like, what shows do you listen to?
I don't know exactly how they get like the same thing with what do they call the ratings?
Like Nielsen ratings. TV.
Yeah. The Nielsen ratings. I don't know exactly how they get them, but basically at this time, for the Zoomers in the audience, they either had the radio or silence. So most of the time they would, you know, someone, if you're driving your car, would just pick a radio station. Because of that, they could somehow get the metrics and realize that, like, during the drive time, during that window that his morning show was, 7.2% of the commuters in Detroit were listening to
Steve Dahl. Got it. That's pretty substantial.
Pretty good. Yeah. No, it's like, it's pretty good. And he is a child, essentially. Like, it's crazy how young he is. But yeah, so because of this success, he was promoted. And moved to Chicago to be the morning host for a pretty substantial rock station there. Before I leave Detroit, I don't know if it was his exact replacement, but he did start working at that radio station that Dahl left and was soon on the air, and his name was Howard Stern.
Right.
Yeah, you heard of him?
Heard and of that Steve, guy.
And Steve Dahl is often compared to him for the same reasons, because like they're both kind of provocative. They bring on, you know, insane guests. They try to rile people up. They just want to get clicks and they're good at it. You know, Howard Stern is a master. Energy. Yep. And you know, I think Howard Stern would like invite porn stars to like try out dildos, like on air, like that kind of slimy, just like, oh, this'll get sickos to click on this. So there's definitely kind of that attitude of just like, you know, radio shock jockey, like just trying to move the needle, get that market share. He's promoted.
What was his sort of deal at this time? So it's a rock. He's like DJing a rock show.
So he's doing the morning show. Very similar. If you've heard of Bob and Tom. It's almost that exact energy.
Okay.
Of just like, oh, these are just a couple of curmudgeons that like joke around and tell stories. you know, while you're driving. And they're charismatic, they're funny, and they'll have their little window where they do their little bits, and they'll have, you know, they'll take calls or whatnot. and yeah, it's very Bob and Tom energy. And it's really interesting because that Bob and Tom energy feels to me like a dad. Like it feels like kind of a, you know, very like older generation, kind of just kind of playfully complaining about the state of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mostly harmless, but just kind of like curmudgeonly growling, complaining. And it's crazy that that type of energy is coming out of, at this point, I think like a 22-year-old. Like, so he gets to Chicago, the new radio station. This is like his dream job. It's a big station, rock and roll. His segment was called Steve Dahl's Rude Awakening.
Oh, good.
Yep. So that's the energy we're dealing with. But folks, unfortunately, Steve Dahl was in for a rude awakening of his own.
Nice.
I see. So on Christmas Eve, 1978, WDAE Chicago fired Steve Dahl in their process of changing the entire rock station into a disco station.
They're rebranding, right?
And they have this huge audience, and they're just seeing this is where the, you know, this is the way the winds are blowing. So Steve Dahl was obviously furious, right? He had his dream job for less than a year. Apparently was doing, you know, not fantastic, but solid. Solid for a 20-year-old.
Yeah, just a boy.
Yeah, so he was absolutely furious. Just like the firing was horrific for Steve. It kind of shapes the trajectory of his entire life. So next up, he finds work at another more modest rock station in Chicago. And a bunch of his fans, which he for some reason calls Cohos. I don't know why. I was trying to look it up, and it seems to be some really obscure local Chicago joke.
Cohos?
Yes, Coho. And so I'm looking at, and there's so many different slangs for it, like cohabitating, co-home, like, and all his of them seem to be wrong. And so Coho, yeah, C-O-H-O. And so I don't know where that comes from, but like that was like what his fans like to be called, or at least what he called them. So a bunch of his fans, pissed about the injustice of his firing, came over, switched over to this new rock station, and ditched the old disco station. This new station was kind of like happy to have him because he was kind of like, oh, this is young buck kid who's doing great. And so they just gave him free reign to do pretty much anything. So his bits got more extreme. He had a very long leash, so he kind of just did what he wants. He would insult callers, you know, he would push the envelope, but mostly he would go on frequent tirades about how stupid disco music was.
Incredibly predictable, yes.
Yes, and it is obviously very personal. Because before this, he wasn't a disco hater. I couldn't find any like actual quotes from like when he was like a teenager, essentially. But he didn't seem to be like an anti-disco advocate. It just was like a genre of music that he just didn't listen to, I'm assuming. And so, yeah, when this happens, everything changes. And he becomes like this anti-disco crusader. Almost like everything he did was about how much he hated disco. And a lot of the execs were like, how is this working? Because his numbers were going up. Like the station almost became more anti-disco than pro rock and roll.
That's what, because, you know, it's funny you describe him as having like dad energy as a 20-year-old. And this is the sort of behavior that I associate with someone like two generations removed from the genre
from
of music
the current pop
that
culture.
They're complaining about. Yeah. So it's wild for him to be this young.
Yes.
Hating on the newest kind of musical trend.
And again, I think so much of this, and we can kind of dive into his psyche at the end, so much of this comes from the personal nature of his firing.
Right,
you know?
Right, of course.
I think if he were to be fired by a country and western station, he'd probably hate country and western. I don't think enough of the country could rally behind him to give him success in hating country and western music. But
as someone who's tried to rally the country behind something like that, I can tell you it does not work. No.
But yeah, he is just super anti-disco.
Is it like the low-hanging fruit? Like, because you already said this is the genre that's associated with kind of marginalized groups, with like black people, brown people, queer people, whatever. Like,
uh-huh.
Is this some sort of like reactionary kind of behavior?
Yes.
Or is it, yeah.
So it does feel that way. And one of the huge debates that we can dive into later is how much of this kind of homophobia, racism, all that reactionary in general, just kind of hating this new thing, being like, why are they shoving this down our throats type deal? I think a lot of it comes from his firing and not the specific things. So I will go out on a limb and say I don't think Steve Dahl is like a super reactionary nightmare, but a lot of his audience is.
That makes sense.
Yes. And so that we'll obviously get into more of that later. But so he even recorded a parody song based on Rod Stewart's "Do You Think I'm Sexy?" which you've probably heard before. And he called it "Do You Think I'm Disco?"
I wear tight pants, I always stuff a sock in. It always makes the ladies start to talk, and my shirt is open. I never use the buttons, though I look hip. I work for EF Hutton. Do you think I'm disco? 'Cause I spend so much time blow drying out my hair.
It's just a song that is very Weird Al energy, and it's just straight up taking down of disco by just describing people who go to discos as, oh, they wear too much gold jewelry, and you know, their hair is too big. Like, just really weird, kind of mild complaints. But that parody song struck a nerve. And to, like, to show how widespread the disco hatred was, it reached number 58 on the Billboard Top 100 in 1979.
God.
So, like, yeah.
That's kind of astonishing.
I know. It really, yeah. He was tapping into a market that was eager for that kind of. So that's Steve Dahl in 1979. And with that, we move into part three, baseball.
So, okay, this is where I get a little quiet, and Dallas.
Okay,
Dallas in a bit more.
So baseball. Now, please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not. This is why you're the official baseball correspondent, Dallas.
Of course.
But during the 70s, baseball was in a bit of a lull. Baseball
is that true? Is that true? Sorry to interrupt, Dallas. Like, expertise, weigh in.
True, yes, absolutely, yeah. But right before the,
80s and 90s.
Right before the steroid era.
Yes.
Right after, yeah, after the Second World War and before the steroid era, yeah, baseball, no good.
It's a bit of a dry spell.
Can we go off on like a little bit of a tangent? That seems
please.
I think of that era as like peak America, you know? Those are the big years of the Cold War. Like, I would expect baseball to be like a huge thing. Why is it not?
And it's crazy. Like, maybe it's almost it wasn't like attendance rates weren't falling, but stadiums were getting bigger, and like it just wasn't growing. It was just kind of in a lull. It wasn't just like, oh God, we are going to have to close down the MLB. But right. Stadiums were rarely full. And I think America is surprisingly fickle with what sports it likes. Right now we are in the heyday of the National Football League.
Yeah.
And this will not last forever. You know, they're signing billion-dollar deal, TV deals and stuff. And this will not last forever. And so this is just a current, you know, the ups and downs of like a major sports league, which crazily at this point, even in the 70s, had been around, like baseball had been around for over a century.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so it has enough historic weight that, you know, they weren't worried about the whole thing collapsing. And we see with the 80s and 90s, it exploding. But this was just a dry spell. So team owners did what they did. They did what every owner has done in the long storied history of baseball. They did wacky and wild promotions.
Mm-hmm.
They would do all sorts of things to get butts in the seats. And so the king of promotions during this time was Chicago White Sox owner Bill Veeck. Have you heard of Bill Veeck? Dallas?
I haven't, no.
Okay. So he
beat him in his own game.
Ah! Yeah. No. Yeah, I don't know the Bill Chicago Veeck, White Sox owner from the 70s. I
know. Yeah.
I can't do it.
So he was a really wild guy, kind of a crazy character in his own right. We don't have a ton of time to get into him, but basically he fought as a Marine in the Second World War. He lost his leg there. He comes back, he gets a wooden leg. Cool. So he's this guy with a wooden leg. He's very handsome, huge chin, kind of a big head, and kind of built like one of those classic capitalism feel-good stories of like bootstraps. Like, he truly did that. Got back from World War II and actually is one of the only owners to like not have an independent fortune that he used to buy the team. He had to be very like deal-making about it.
I'm looking at pictures of him now. I don't know how to like describe this other than to say that he's like balding in a way that's hot.
Yes, that's a perfect description.
Oh, wow.
That's hilarious. Dude, yes, that is a perfect. And so basically he has this wooden leg that he will occasionally replace with like different peg legs and was kind of funny about it. And he was a chain smoker, which is smoking constantly.
Uh-huh. He also has a cigarette between his fingers in this picture I'm looking at.
And so in his peg legs, he would have carved into the wood an ashtray for his cigarette.
Oh, that's incredible.
Isn't that awesome?
Was it like he would like hit a button on the side and like a little ashtray would like swing out? That's what I'm picturing.
No. I think it's just in the wood, like just straight up carved in, like almost a cup holder.
Like a little divot, just, like, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so he's quite the character, and he is known at this time as the King of Promotions. The league itself was not doing good, and the White Sox, the Chicago White Sox, were doing even worse. They were in very bad shape. But this guy was a really good promoter. The way he kind of really got famous at first was he recruited extensively out of the Negro leagues.
Mm-hmm.
He hired on Larry Doby and broke the color barrier for the American League just 3 months after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier for the National League.
Oh, okay.
So Vex at the time, they called it a gamble, you know, but it's insane to even call it a gamble back then. Like, they were really good at baseball. And it paid off because his team filled with Negro League players won the World Series the next year.
Oh, like immediately.
Yeah, like literally the next year.
Yeah.
So, and that really opened the door of being like, oh, these guys are really good at baseball. Like, and so he was kind of like not really progressive, but he was very much a trailblazer in that way. And it's quite the character. So in the 70s, this guy, Bill Veeck, owns the Chicago White Sox. And like I said, they were horrible. They were so bad. And so to combat that, to get the stadium even half full sometimes, Veeck would do these just insane promotions, you know, petting zoos in the parking lots, extensive use of fireworks. He was one of the first to have like planes fly over the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like very much like just had to get people in the seats. And so he has this famous quote: "You can draw more people with a losing team plus bread and circuses than with a losing team and a long, still silence."
That's pretty nice.
Yeah, hard to argue with that.
Yeah, yeah. So he's all into these promotions, and really that's kind of keeping the White Sox alive. Like, there were rumors of the Chicago, this enormous city. They're like, is it really big enough for two baseball teams? You know, with the Cubs too. So he was really like pulling stuff out of his hat. When asked about his favorite team, instead of saying like the local Chicago Bulls, he said the Harlem Globetrotters. Like, he's a showman at heart. He's got some P.T. Barnum in him. And so Bill Veeck hires on his son, Mike Veeck, as the head of promotions. And the two are thick as thieves. Like, they, father and son promoters, are having fun just planning, you know, the bread and circuses required to get people to watch this atrocious baseball team. In the spring of 1979, the father and son promoter, they get a call from a local Chicago radio shock jock DJ named Steve Dahl.
Wow.
Part 4, Disco Demolition Night.
Oh, hell yeah.
It's all coming together.
So Steve Dahl, in his continued crusade against disco, had ordered his like legions of fans to sneak. He would have them do all sorts of things, like sneak into disco clubs with like boom boxes, like hidden in trench coats, and then all pull them out together and just start blasting rock music. Like, God. You know,
that's so annoying.
I know.
Really,
right?
Really annoying.
It's just like, why? God. Like what? It's insane. Like, and he'd order them to like throw marshmallows at like, disco performers that would like famous disco people that would arrive in the city. He'd say, they're in this car, you know, throw marshmallows at it.
I guess he, you know, is, so, I mean, I assume he's a little older now, but like,
yeah, at this point, I think he's no, at this point he is 24.
Okay. Well,
isn't that crazy? He's still super young.
Still kind of a, you know, the childish behavior makes a little bit of sense, I guess.
Yeah, it's weird because it's childish behavior mixed with kind of like grumpy old man behavior. It's
These like all these adult men are like taking orders from this like 24-year-old
and the co-host.
They're like having a meeting. They're like, I wonder what he's going to tell us to do. And then he's like, hey, yes, guys, we can like throw marshmallows at their car.
Yes, like, and they're like, yeah,
they're like,
yeah,
no, okay.
Like, no, literally, they declared themselves like an anti-disco army.
That's so dumb. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
And so they would wear like military regalia that they would buy from like army surplus stores and whatnot. And yeah.
That's so lame.
I know. So he had this plan to blow up a box of disco records at a shopping mall live on air. And that's something that Steve Dahl does a lot, is he will like, was kind of a, not really a pioneer, but would do more bits like outside the studio. And so this was one of them.
Well, I'm trying to imagine the appeal of the like audio experience of a, exactly, just like a box, yeah, of records blowing up.
No, dude, this is way later on, but he gets his vasectomy live on air.
Oh my. On the radio he gets it?
Yes. I don't know if it's on the radio or he just recorded it or whatever, but it was like, yeah. Everything is content to this man.
Yeah, I do see that the Howard Stern parallels are very apt, I think.
Yes,
it's like,
yeah,
on the radio, just like it's been like 15 minutes of silence. It's like, boy, they're still doing it. They're still getting the vasectomy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's really happening.
So basically he had planned to blow up this huge box of disco records at a shopping mall. But he started to dream bigger. And bigger and bigger, to eventually he's like, why not just ask if I can blow up this box of disco records at Comiskey Park, where the White Sox play. The year previously, they had a promotion called Disco Night. And he's saying, shouldn't the anti-disco folks get their turn?
Oh.
So he
consider myself something of a hater, but this is the dumbest stuff I've ever heard.
Surely nothing will go wrong. So he calls up Mike Beck, and basically the guy just says, absolutely, sure. Go nuts. You know, like, this is just like music to his
ears. It's publicity, yeah.
So they scheduled what they called Disco Demolition Night. And it was scheduled for Thursday, July 12th, 1979. And they would blow up a box of donated records in center field right after like the end of the game, the last inning. But in addition, there was a rain delay for a previous game against they were going to play the Detroit Tigers. And so suddenly July 12th became what they call a twi-night doubleheader. So it's kind of a 2-for-1, you know, two games, at the same stadium right after one after the other.
Okay.
And so the original promotion for the delayed game was Teen Night, where younger people got in for like dirt cheap. And so that promotion was also on the same night, 'cause it was kind of doubled up on promotions.
Oh, this feels like there's going to be some tensions brewing.
And so in addition, if you brought a disco record to be destroyed that you'd place in this like enormous tub at the entrance, your ticket price was suddenly 98 cents.
Brilliant.
Now, despite all of these incentives, Steve Dahl and the other like promoters were terrified that the stadium would still be like less than half full, that there'd still be so many empty seats. So because of that fear, over the course of like the months or the weeks leading up to Disco Demolition Night, Dahl was like pleading with his audience to show up. He's like, guys, you got the Coho, you know, Lips army has to get here. You know, we have to. So yeah, he pleads with his audience to please show up. And show up they did. So, the day of, Thursday, July 12th, 1979, lines to get into the park circled the block hours before they even opened the gates. Almost everyone was holding a disco record. Some people brought a ton of disco records and just handed them out to the people in line.
This is honestly sounding great for the disco music industry.
So many in the crowd were a part of Doll's like anti-disco army. A lot of them, like I said, were wearing military surplus gear.
Never a good sign.
Yeah, and a lot of the records weren't obviously their records. There were records that in some cases they stole. But in most cases, they took from like their sister or like their siblings or like they took them from other people. A lot of them weren't like disco records that they owned.
Right.
So, many of them had boom boxes that they were, you know, trying to hide in their trench coats or military
just
jackets.
Subtly tucking an entire boom box into the pocket of your trench coat.
So a lot of them brought cases of beer, bottles of whiskey, flasks, all sorts. Some of them even brought their own fireworks, like firecrackers, Roman candles. But again, almost all of them had a disco record to add to the pile. Like there was this enormous like tub box thing that was placed at each entrance. And an hour before the first inning, all of them are overflowing, like literally piling up like in a pile around the box. They sold on record 47,000 tickets. Comiskey Park seats 44,000 people.
Wow. Okay.
So the owner Vec immediately orders the gates to be closed. Like he's like, we're over, you know, it's not like nowadays where everything's on a computerized system and it almost like won't let you sell a ticket over capacity.
Yeah.
Back then it was a little slower and you could miscount. And you know, once you go, oh crap, entrance three came in and they sold 5,000 tickets. We're over. He ordered the gates closed and ordered all the security to abandon the field where they were at and make sure that just no one got in. There were still 20,000 people outside the stadium on top of the almost 50,000 people. And these are just confirmed people that are inside.
These are people who hate disco.
Now, hold on. They're people that hate disco. They are teenagers coming for cheap teen night.
Oh, right.
And
right,
also
right.
Just normal White Sox fans, which there are still a few, despite how bad they were. So it isn't all anti-disco people, but this promotion has worked, and it has worked exceedingly well. So security is outmatched, but Vec is freaking out and is, you know, calling the Chicago Police Department and orders them to shut down the off ramps from the interstate to get to the stadium, which they do. Like it's that bad. It's like backed up. Like yeah. So things are tense. It is packed. But the game begins. A local model, who's just like, you know, this beautiful bombshell like model, almost like borderline porn star. Who would do like all sorts of like scandalous stuff and was also like was of course interviewed by Steve Dahl on rock station all the time. Players from both teams notice the electricity in the air as this model throws out the first pitch. This was the biggest crowd Comiskey Park had ever had. Wow. And more people were getting in by the minute. As the game went on, people outside, worried they were going to miss the explosion, jumped turnstiles, they climbed fences, or a lot of them were actually hoisted up like Rapunzel, like up to the cheap seats from the top.
Oh my God.
That's like real, like they can't stop all of us, you know.
Yes.
Storm Area 51 energy.
Yeah. Yes. So, like I said, people are packed in like sardines. All sorts of bottles of liquor are being passed around. Joints, blunts are being passed around. There's a haze of marijuana smoke that just hangs over the entire stadium. And it's crazy because there is a few, there, you know, bits of video of this and you can see just the haze, just the, and so, they put up all sorts of banners and placards. A lot of them had slurs on them.
Seems bad.
It was pretty, yeah, a lot of like very, lot of vitriol, a lot of venom dripping from a lot of these angry people.
Okay, so this is again the anti-disco thing.
It is
a racist thing.
So that's the debate, right? Is it like?
Okay, so if there's a debate, the answer is yes, right?
Yes, no, of course they are racist. Of course, the racists and homophobes of all sorts. From what I've researched about Steve Dahl, I really don't think he is racist or homophobic. I really don't. But he is willing to stoke those fears for a huge event, which, again, at the end of the day, basically the same thing, right? Yeah. Like, that's kind of where I'm at. Because it is tough, because I really do, like, believe this guy when he says he's not racist or homophobic, but he is so willing to, like, dog whistle and stoke those fears. Like,
man doing racism and homophobia.
Yes,
claims
yes,
to yeah. not be personally racist or homophobic. Like, and of course, it doesn't matter what he was in his heart, obviously. Like,
exactly. Like, the actual nature of it is extremely, like, toxic. So yeah. There's a huge banner that hangs over center field, like, enormous hand-painted banner. I have no idea how they got, like, that much fabric. But it says just "Disco sucks" in all caps, like, hanging over center field. Yeah. They start playing the game. It's a very rowdy, loud crowd. One of the players said, like, it feels like the World Series here. Like, what in the world? The game had to be stopped by the umpires several times from firecrackers being lit and then thrown on the field. And mostly disco records being thrown like frisbees. Just sticking in, like, you know, the outfield. The energy was just vibrating. The legendary, have you heard of this guy, Dallas? Harry Caray?
No, I don't think so.
He's like an old school announcer.
Okay. You know,
really just loves the game of baseball. Eventually switches over to the Cubs later on and is, like, super famous there. He's got stuff named after him and whatnot, but he is like a really, like, high caliber old school sports announcer. And even he is, like, trying not to break and, like, not comment on, like, the marijuana smell and, like, the sounds of, like, glass breaking. but he lets a few slip through, and it's kind of lets a few, like, let's calm down, guys, in the broadcast. So one other person I'll mention before we get into the actual boom, is Vince Lawrence. So he was an usher at Kaminsky Park, and an important detail is that Lawrence was black. And so as an usher, and as a black usher, he saw some of the vitriol, like, firsthand. And one thing he noted, he later did, like, an interview with NPR where he gave, like, a lot of the really interesting details of this. But one thing he noticed was when he looked at this overflowing box of disco records, he saw albums by Tyrone Davis, Curtis Mayfield, Otis Clay, Sam Cooke, records that were clearly not disco.
Yeah, nothing to do with the genre.
Nope,
yeah.
Nope, but they were just by black artists.
Right.
Another fan, he recounts, like, got into his face, broke a disco record in his face and said, "You like that?" Jeez. And just the feeling he mentioned, he said, it's almost as if something about me was inherently disco. Just because of the way I looked. Since Lawrence was in an usher's uniform, we can probably narrow it down to how he looked was the color of his skin. You know,
right.
This guy just sees a black guy. He associates with like the, you know, people who do disco, breaks the disco, you know. Vince Lawrence gives some pretty, pretty damning firsthand account of what's going on at the stadium that day. So we'll circle back to him later. He's got a pretty cool end to the story. But some of the attendees that were not part of Dahl's anti-disco army obviously felt uncomfortable. You know, like they were like, let's get out of here. And they decide to leave. However, on the way out, they see people just packed in, continuing to move in what they call nowadays a crush. A lot of the exits they couldn't even get to because too many people were hopping the barricades and coming in. And the few people that could actually get to the few gates where there wasn't like this just flow of people, they found the gates padlocked.
Whoa.
Like, security had just straight up padlocked the gates. So Do not let anyone in. Yep. But yeah, nobody in. But unfortunately, that means for the people who are like, all right, I do not want to be here anymore, nobody out as well. So that was rough. People were kind of trapped in some of these exit points. And yeah, in fact, every single entry or exit point at this time was locked shut by security. Straight from the top. And the one that was still open, had this just crowd of people that you just impenetrable. You couldn't get out. So the first game ended at 8:15 p.m. Detroit won the game 4-1. So the White Sox lost, kind of adding to like the negative energy in the in the stadium. But now it was in between the doubleheader. So end of game one, game two will start in 30, 45 minutes. This is where the promotion would take place. It was now Steve Dahl's time to shine. So he drives out onto the field in an army Jeep, wearing military fatigues and like a green, soldier's helmet. The model, who threw out the first pitch, also rode in the Jeep, to raucous cheers. And so they drove around the field, like literally, they're just, there's a Jeep driving over like the baseball field. people are showering them in beer cans and whiskey bottles that are like breaking. A lot of them are throwing some of their disco records, maybe just to cause chaos, maybe in hopes that Steve Dahl will pick them up or someone will pick them up and put them onto the pile that will be exploded. But regardless, there is just vinyl raining down on them, like frisbees, just like sticking into the turf like ninja stars. So they drove around the field and then proceeded to center field, where this enormous box containing the records was waiting for them and rigged with explosives.
This is going to be all over the newspapers, all over the television, all over radio, all over the city, all over the country, and everybody's going to know us rock and rollers here in Chicago think disco sucks. Disco sucks. Disco sucks. Disco sucks. We're going to attempt the world's largest disco demolition. But first, we have a musical treat for you. Please welcome the Village People. What? You don't like the Village People? Oh. How about that in summer? Oh, gee, that's too bad. We had her waiting off in the wings, too. How about the Bee Gees? Oh, I see. Okay. Well, listen, we took all the disco records that you brought tonight. We got them in a giant box. And we're going to blow them up. Real good.
Oh my god.
Crowd goes wild.
All this time I'm just picturing a guy who like is part of this like anti-disco thing who like shows up to this like big event and just like, wait, all of you guys are doing this for like racist reasons? I thought we all just didn't like syncopated drums. Like, I really don't like the sound. It makes my ears hurt. Like, I really just don't like it. It makes my head spin. I gotta get out of here.
I'm thinking of all the like 70-year-old season ticket holders for this terrible baseball team.
Yeah.
Where this stadium is never even half full. Uh-huh. And it's suddenly bursting at the seams. Like, can you imagine? And you can't get out. Like,
yeah, that's who I'm infuriated for. The guys who just came for a good old game, they came for a hot dog and a brew, and now all of a sudden their life looks messy and
you're like, this is a perversion of the pure experience
of the purity of
exactly.
American pastime.
Like, they might as well just start doing the wave, and I'm already so pissed,
So we're at the moment of glory, Steve. I don't know. I couldn't find exact video of this. I don't know if he pressed a button or had one of those like hilarious like boxes with like the thing you push down,
like the Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, like one of those, like just over the top.
I hope so.
Yeah, regardless, however he triggers it, there is an enormous explosion from this box of records. And there are a few around it, like fireworks that were clearly attempted to like, make it look bigger than it was. But those fireworks were not needed. This thing exploded and shards of vinyl go everywhere. A plume of smoke rises up to join the weed haze. And of course the crowd goes fucking nuts. Like it's just pandemonium. Moments after this explosion of Disco Records, some of the people notice that the security that is on the field, that kind of is like, you know, in a lot of sporting events, there's like security on the field kind of looking outwards. And I always joke like, oh, they can't even watch the game. They gotta, you know, watch the stands. Those guys are all gone trying to stop people from getting in. Mm-hmm. So there is no security on the field. So naturally, one person jumps over, another jumps over, and suddenly we are rushing the field. There is just the field becomes bombarded with disco records even more, and just people jumping. And it, from some of the stands, it's a pretty big fall. A lot of the people in the cheap seats began sliding down the foul poles like firemen.
Oh my God.
Get down to the actual field. You know, people are falling. There is some injuries, but it is just pandemonium. So it's just insane. So the Detroit Tigers, who are, you know, they just won their first game, hoping to win another. They go out during this pandemonium, you know, and try to warm up.
They're just acting like nothing is happening.
Well, they try for a minute, but after people really start storming the field, and one, I think the catcher notices, like, once you see like whiskey bottles hitting next to you, like this it obviously like made them think twice, and they literally like ran for cover. Both teams retreated to their dugouts and treated them like bunkers, like literally barricaded the entrances. Wow. And so yeah, it's just absolute chaos. Fans who stormed the field began starting bonfires to burn using some of like the what do they call that? The record fold, like the paper case the record comes in. They start using that to start bonfires and then tossing the records onto said bonfires. Fans stole first base. Then they stole second, and then third, and then home. And by not stealing the base in a baseball term, literally they just took the bases. Mm-hmm. people are sliding down the foul pole still. People are being like smashed up again, like as people are pushing forward, they're just kind of squished against the barricades. Like a smell of burning vinyl fills the air.
That can't be good for your lungs.
Nope. So Bill Veeck, the owner of this, he hobbles out. Remember, wooden leg with the ashtray in it. Hobbles out to where home plate used to be, and got on the microphone and just starts telling people, please return to your seats. Like, stop this disorderly conduct at once. To no avail, obviously. Chaos continues. Steve Dahl even approaches one of them and says like, hey, let me back on the field. I can call off my army. His offer was declined.
I can call off my army.
So the old timer, Harry Caray, the like sanctity of the game baseball announcer, he is just making pleas over the intercom about, you know, the sanctity of baseball. Please stop this at once. They even just start playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, like the seventh inning stretch, in hopes that will like get people to stop. Their new scoreboard, they were very proud of, that actually could shoot fireworks out of it. It was just continually flashing, please return to your seats, in all caps. Eventually, security finally got back onto the fields, and the police arrived with like riot gear. and started, you know, there were some brawls. It was just absolute chaos, pandemonium, like one of those rare events where like you see kind of the facade of like order, you know, like you see oh yeah, this is just a lot of people in a place and it's well-managed and well-run, but it's like, you're like three events away from like, just, you know, oh crap, I'm in a stadium surrounded by essentially 70,000 other people.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's just kinda, it's getting nuts.
It highlights the degree to which you just kind of take for granted, and you know, rightfully so, that like for the most part, people will just kind of like abide by
the rules, the sort of normal sense of
how to like operate as a large crowd.
Yeah, like standing in a line and like, yeah, you don't really think about how it's insane that people can be that well behaved. But this is where like, you know, the facade cracks. It's like, oh my gosh, just absolute, like I said, pandemonium. So security gets back, the police officers with riot gear start pushing people off the field, you know, getting in some sparring matches with their batons versus, you know, drunk guys holding whiskey bottles. 39 people are arrested for disorderly conduct. They eventually begin to get people out of the stadium again. And so at this point, the umpires are like, what do we do? Like, there are shards of like broken records sticking out of the outfield. Like, what do we do here? You know, like, and so what they do is they get on the phone with the American League president and they're like, hey, what do we do? And so there was kind of this debate raging as they were trying to calm this down. The Tigers managers, so the ones they had won the first game, the Detroit Tigers, they said the White Sox have to forfeit, you know, and they pointed in the rule book where it states that the home team must provide adequate playing conditions or else forfeit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and he just goes, look behind me. There's bonfires still going on the field. I forgot to mention, there's literally a crater in center field where the explosion happened. Like just dirt crater.
Just like a smoking crater.
Yes. And so meanwhile, Bill Veeck, the White Sox owner, is trying to argue that, you know, we'll get it situated and we'll probably have to postpone it again, unfortunately. You know, he says, you know, this is no different than the rain that postponed, you know, the first game. So he asked for the president for it to be postponed again. Like, and he pointed to a part of the rule book where it states that a game must be replayed if the game could not be played due to an act of God. So that was his
argument. God hates disco. Is the implication.
Well, so like basically, while I don't have an exact quote, I can imagine the American League president essentially saying like, my friend Bill, this was no act of God. So the president sides with the Detroit Tigers manager and says like, these are clearly not adequate playing conditions. And he ordered that the White Sox had to forfeit the second game at the doubleheader. It is one of only five forfeits in MLB history. They are usually always delayed because, you know, baseball stadiums usually outside, rain delays. It's just kind of built in, you know, to the DNA of the league. I'm just like, we're going to have to move this one later. But this is one of only one in five that was forfeited.
Dallas trivia chat.
MLB history.
What are the others?
Oh, I couldn't even. It honestly surprises me that there's even one more because,
it's so rare.
Especially today, like they'll do anything. Like they'll play doubleheaders. They'll do they'll move it to a completely different month. Like they will do scheduled gymnastics.
They'll do without fans.
Yeah, they'll do scheduled gymnastics to make sure every game is played. And so it surprises me that there's even one more. Yeah.
There's two that I can remember. I was looking at the list. I think two of them are boring. The other two, one was like some riots. I think it might have been. It might have been one of the like race riots of the 90s. Like, and they're just like, we can't get to the game. And then another one, I think another one was 10 Cent Beer Night.
Oh, which,
you do the math there.
feels about right.
just turned into like a rowdy, you know, same kind of deal, like just drunken people stumbling over, puking, you know, falling onto the
listen, I, you know, if anybody affiliated with the sort of like Dodgers is listening, if there's one thing that will get me back in the stadium, it would be Ted's and beer night. You know, I would show up. I would pay the like $40-$50, whatever it is, for a ticket.
Oh yeah.
If I knew that once I arrived, the normally like $23 beers were 10 cents.
Yeah, dude, like just insane. It might have been 5-cent beer night. Like it was insane. Like
honestly, you know, that's going too far.
Yeah, there's your line.
Yeah.
March of Dimes.
That'll bring in another you know, wave of people that is just like, you know, let's keep it at 10 cents. You know?
Yeah, 10 cents. So yeah, very rare. But yeah, this is just one of those moments in baseball history where it's like they had to forfeit. And
per the rules.
Yeah, yeah. No, most people have settled on like, yeah, that's crazy. So in the rule book, when you forfeit a game, the other team, it goes in the scorebook as the other team winning 9-0.
Wow.
Which I did not know either. It's just a random quirk. It's
so
like,
that,
yeah.
That affects the stats.
I think, I don't know if baseball has like, do they default to like highest score? Like, is that ever included in like the playoff seeding or anything, Dallas?
I don't think so. Like run differential, I don't think is ever included in tiebreaker playoff stuff. There's so many games in a season, 162 or whatever I think it is, that it really never gets down to something that deep. Like, whereas the NFL is only 17, so you can clearly get some scenarios. But with 162 games, you don't need that many tiebreakers.
Yeah. So I was just curious, like it was a little interesting thing of like, yeah, they wrote down the thing you have to at a forfeit. The team that forfeited loses 0-9, which is just something a quirk I didn't know about. But yeah, the White Sox had to forfeit due to the chaos of Disco Demolition Night.
50,000 people, the largest crowd of the season, showed up at Chicago's Comiskey Park for the twi-night doubleheader between the White Sox and the Detroit Tigers. 15,000 others had to be turned away. Many had come for Disco Demolition Night, a promotional gimmick. Between games, as planned, a huge box containing thousands of disco records was blown up. Yeah! That looked real good! The rest was unplanned. Fans stormed out onto the field in the thousands. Disco records were hurled like frisbees. Bonfires were set. Bottles were thrown. The batting cage was torn down and destroyed. Fistfights broke out. White Sox players had to be locked in their clubhouse for their own protection. The melee lasted an hour and a half and resulted in 39 arrests and a few minor injuries. The baseball fans missed the second game. It was canceled. The White Sox lost it.
Part 5, Aftermath. The day after the event, Dahl began his regular like morning broadcast. Business as usual. And he spent his entire hour reading the indignant headlines of the local papers. He mocked almost all the coverage. And he said this quote, "I think for the most part, everything was wonderful. Some maniac cohos got wild, went down on the field, which you shouldn't have done. Bad little cohos."
Oh my god.
That, like, just the tone is so patronizing and horrible. Ugh. So yeah, that was the day after. So he obviously didn't get in much trouble for that. The Tigers manager, so the manager for the other team, said, "Sure, beer and baseball go together. They have for years. But I think those kids were doing things other than beer," unquote.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Which is just a funny little, like, here's some other quotes. So this guy, this columnist for the Chicago Tribune, David Israel, is just defending Dahl, the White Sox, and kind of like the city of Chicago. And he says in his article that I think was the next day or the day after, he said, quote, "It would have happened any place 50,000 teenagers got together on a sultry summer night with beer and reefer," unquote.
Sultry summer night.
Beer and reefer, which sounds like an awesome time, dude. Sultry summer night with beer and reefer.
Yeah, I think if it was just like, you know, sultry teens, beer and weed, that would be one thing. But the fact that it was like the anti-disco sentiment that was animating the whole thing.
Yeah, it's very much a few bad apples energy coming from this columnist.
Right.
So, and then one of my favorite quotes is from the pitcher of the White Sox, Rich Wortham. He was a native Texan, and he simply said, "This wouldn't have happened on country and western night."
You could take that quote from an event like this.
It's so good.
You could take that quote from an event like this, and if you told me any pitcher today said something like that, I would absolutely believe you. Like the demographic has not changed in the slightest.
Yeah, dude. Like just a Texan just be like, "This wouldn't have happened on country and western."
Which is funny. It's like, this is like
so funny.
It wasn't even disco night. It was anti-disco night.
I know. It's just, God. Anyway, so those are some fun quotes I found. So I will basically just end with kind of a where are they now. And so I'll start with disco. Disco is such a strange thing. The metaphor I kind of came up with was, right now I'm doing this and since this is a Patreon episode, like I'll give a little peek behind the curtain. Basically, I'm doing so much research right now with Project Cybersyn, which involves cybernetics, which is another term where it's like cybernetics. It feels almost quaint. It feels almost like, like, oh, that's kind of like a retrofuturism idea that just fizzled during the Cold War or something like that. Mm-hmm. But in reality, cybernetics is everywhere, right?
Like
big data,
thinking.
Cybernetics. Yeah. Yes, it is literally like we live in a cybernetic world. It's like the adage, like what is it? Like a fish doesn't know what water is just because it's like, it's so familiar. It's like, he's always swimming in it. So it's like, you can't even recognize water. And the term I found, that I really love, I can't remember where I found it. It's called, obliterated by ubiquity, where cybernetics didn't die. It didn't fizzle out. It just became everything else. Like, and so the same thing happened with disco. It didn't die. It just became everything else. Like, you look at any pop song, you look at any Taylor Swift bop, there is disco in the DNA, right? You look at any rap song, you look at any, especially like house, EDM, you know, electronic music.
Yeah.
It's disco. It is so much disco is like baked in, that today, like, it's kind of like this cute little 70s callback to be like, oh, disco. But it's like disco won. Like it won the war in the grand scheme of things by kind of becoming everything. And like I saw it compared to Obi-Wan. Like how Obi-Wan dies.
You can't win, Darth. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine.
Like disco becomes one with the Force and kind of like is omnipresent.
Right. Like
after its quote unquote death.
I don't think this radio DJ, what's his name, even the radio
Steve
DJ?
Steve Dahl.
I don't think Dahl even could have rallied the amount of like antipathy towards this genre if it weren't clear that it was going to kind of like be massively influential, right?
Yeah. That is like, in a way, Steve Dahl was right. Like his way of music, like his way was changing. And, you know, the world is always ending and changing and shifting. And like, you know, that's just the eternal reactionary call to be like, can we make it how we used to, you know, and just, yeah. And so I really, it is, I think that term is so good. When I found it for cybernetics, I think it applies so much here. It says obliterated by ubiquity. Like it's everywhere. Like it's a part of almost any music, you know, that kind of synthy.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
Is in every, you know, like it's just, yeah, it's almost omnipresent. So I thought it was really cool how they often refer to this. And I'll probably title it because it's a great title. Like The Day Disco Died. Mm-hmm, but it is just so, perhaps there's a Christ metaphor here, folks.
It's the quote.
Find it.
To became the Holy Spirit.
to quote from Disco Elysium, a game that I don't even know if people listening to this have played, but quote, should. The limbed and headed machine of pain
and undignified suffering is firing up again. It wants to walk the desert, hurting, longing, dancing to disco music.
Yes, dude, I love that. Such a good quote. I think that's the quote like when you first become conscious, right?
I think so. I think that happens like right in the beginning when you're waking up.
That's, yeah. Oh, it's so good. And, but one of my favorite songs, an old song by the, I guess it's not even that old, but the Limousines, Internet Killed the Radio Star. Have you heard that song?
Oh, yeah.
The kids are disco dancing, they're tired of rock and roll. I tried to tell them, hey, that drum machine ain't got no soul.
Now it's been a complete swing the other way. You know, it's kind of like jokingly complaining about, like, kids these days don't want to have guitars and actual drum sets. They want, you know, vocalizers and drum machines and synth stuff.
Which is like, that's kind of the same energy as Dahl a little bit, right? Like, just griping and complaining.
Yes, yes. And no, so, and like, it almost, that song is almost kind of like a warning, like, to not fall in the same trap of, like, oh no, things are changing, and that therefore worse, you know. But yeah, my friends, disco is alive and well. And man, I'd love to bring back that word as like a positive adjective. Be like, that's so disco, man.
Good luck with that. I'm gonna make
that my word of the summer. So jot that down, folks. So next on our Where Are They Now? Disco is thriving. What about the White Sox? They're kind of a character in the story. Dallas.
Oh, yeah.
How are the White Sox doing? Are they? Oh. I know they won the World Series in, like, what, 04, 05?
Yeah.
But, like, how are they doing now?
Well, this season they are a very sort of notable disaster, actually.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. So right now, the White Sox, they had a really good star player by the name of Jose Abreu signed away from them in the offseason this year. Uh-huh. And so but they have a lot of really good players outside of him. So they really they were really sort of very hopeful in their division to sort of maybe come out on top or perhaps just like sneak in and make some noise in the postseason. But
yeah,
they had a litany of injuries to star players and then also a couple people who have, you know, severely sort of underperformed their past performances. They have a new manager this year, which is an upgrade because their old manager was truly a walking corpse. And like really old timer, like when it was upsetting to most people how like that he was even managing at this point. So
amusing and endearing, sort of like Biden, you know, the first walking corpse that kind of comes to mind for me.
Yeah. No, it's sort of the opposite of that, where it's like he has, I think this was part of the reason everyone was so frustrated, because the White Sox in recent years have had players who really like to sort of celebrate themselves and, you know, play very loose and very fun. He would often admonish them for such things.
Oh, is he one of those guys who doesn't like the bat flip?
Yes.
Because he says it's disrespect. Insane.
Yeah, so that kind of stuff. But, and then one more note on the current state of the White Sox, actually a more, to end on a positive note, they have a relief pitcher who recently, like in the last few months, beat cancer.
And
he's actually coming back. I mean, maybe this week is he's going to make his return to the mound. And he's been pitching well in his sort of rehab starts. And so, you know, they think he's going to be, you know, just back to his original form, which, you know, is really miraculous. So, so positive note, they've got a pitcher who beat cancer coming back this week. And he's going to be that's going to be a really warm moment. Probably for them.
Yeah, there we go. So the White Sox aren't doing great, but
yeah,
that guy is.
Yeah, that guy's way up.
So next up on our Where Are They Now, owner Bill Veeck. So, you know, the guy, quite the character, one leg, the peg leg had a ashtray in it, that guy. So shortly after this, he was already known as kind of a maverick owner, and this just put him over the edge. He wasn't officially like blacklisted, but he was very much like not allowed to make any big moves any longer. And he was already pretty old. And so he sold the team 2 years later and died in the 80s. It's well regarded by most baseball fans. He made the Hall of Fame as an owner. So wow. He's quite the character. His son, Mike Veeck, he has an awesome quote. I didn't write it down specifically in my notes, but he basically said, as soon as the first person jumped onto the field, he said, I knew right then my life was over.
Oh.
All of them knew, like they could feel almost like right as they saw the lines waiting to get into the park, they're like, this, it might be really bad. Like they were all just sweating bullets and like seeing them like on the field being like, please stop guys. You know, like their ties are like their collared shirt is unbuttoned and they're like just, but he's got kind of a fun story. So basically once his dad, after this, he was reprimanded, you know, it was not fun. He had to do a bunch of, you know, cover and PR stuff. So he stopped doing those ambitious promotions that the White Sox were known for. They toned it down immensely. But he still stuck around the team until his dad sold in 81. He later bought a minor league team. He kind of still had that stink on him where it was hard for him to get into the majors in any big promotional way. So he just kind of dove headfirst in promotions in general and bought a minor league team called the St. Paul Saints, where he continues to do insane promotions. And he does these insane promotions with the help of co-owner Bill Murray.
Okay, I was going to ask because I was looking him up earlier. You were mentioning his dad and Bill Murray kept coming up in the articles I was looking at.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I don't know if he was a local or anything, but I know Bill Murray, I think he's a huge baseball fan. And a lot of like the viral videos you'll get of him like interacting with fans or like doing something silly for like a promotion or like tackling a mascot or whatever is a lot of that is with the St. Paul Saints. So they are having a blast in the minor leagues, still doing that kind of old school barnstorming style, like promotions to get people into, you know, seats of a AAA or AA game.
Yeah, that's the place to do it for sure.
Yes, yeah. So he's doing good, I guess. So one such promotion that Mike Feck did in 2014 was destroying Justin Bieber merch.
Oh, he did it again.
He did it again.
Come on.
He went back to the well. He did. Isn't that?
And did people turn out? Who even hates Justin Bieber? I don't even have a demographic category for hating Justin Bieber.
I think 2014 high school boy might have a hatred.
In 2014, a high school boy had Justin Bieber's haircut.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. There was a few. I remember not liking Justin Bieber. I would never go to a destructive merch thing. You know, like
right.
Destroying merch.
You know, it's that thing of like, you know, you can't stand him because you want to be him so bad. Like that was what it all was.
You want to
be him and you never will be like, and so you're just jealous of him. Like, yeah,
well, see,
and that's all it was.
Okay. Getting into that. Like I think a lot of that, you know, of course there's racism, homophobia, but I think a lot of this kind of hatred of disco was a little bit of weird jealousy because it's like these people could express themselves. Like discos were fun as hell, like and they got to break the mold and just do random dances, and you know, like they didn't have to go line dancing or square dancing or, you know, it was more communal, it was more, and so I think a lot of these people, their hatred kind of stems from a thing of like, I didn't get to have that, so they right. shouldn't either.
They're,
you know,
just mad at Justin Bieber for releasing one of the great all-time Christmas albums with, you know, Busta Rhymes rhyming vanilla and chinchilla.
With a little sprinkle of vanilla, even though it's kind of cold, I'm pulling out a chinchilla. Bieber hit me back.
I'll see if I can find that merch destruction promotion.
Yeah, I'd be curious.
If I can, like, include the audio, that'd be fun.
My goodness.
I don't want to speak for you guys, but I feel like confident in saying that this is a pro Bieber podcast.
Easy.
Historium.
Nope. We cannot take an official stance. I'm looking at the numbers.
Boyfriend.
We cannot make a claim about
this. I'm going to do it. I don't care about the numbers. This is a pro Bieber podcast.
Citing ongoing legal matters, I cannot comment.
I cannot. So, finally, we get to our final person. Where are they now? Steve Dahl. I want both of you to take a wild guess of what Steve Dahl, he is alive. What do you think Steve Dahl is doing right now?
He's a lobbyist.
No, unfortunately he is not.
My guess would be that he is the host of like a Fear Factor-esque reality show on one of like Freevee or Tubi or like one of the like streaming services that will clearly like die or be absorbed into Max within the next 2 years.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Steve, as he says, he will admit, has a face for radio.
Okay.
That only leaves kind of one thing left.
Is he a podcaster? Steve Dahl
is a podcaster. Dude, he's got the podcast network, baby.
A podcast network. And,
the lowest of the low.
It's so funny. It is awesome. Like, he releases now about once a month. And it's just telling like an old story from it, like, you know, like it's just purely like reminiscent and like, yeah, just I've only listened to a few and it was hard to.
Can you drop a clip in here to give us like a taste? Like what's his deal now?
Oh, God, you could look up just Steve Dahl podcast and
it's bad news.
Like almost exactly. He's just like kind of continued that curmudgeonly, like a charismatic complainer and just, you know. Has ended up making
he like hates 100 gecks now. Now he's like anti like Zoomer music. So like what's his deal?
Yeah. So he has gotten a lot of flack as the decades have gone on and disco, you know, quote unquote died, but then, you know, has become super popular. And looking back, it just seems like this weird, quaint hatred of such a specific music genre that like it's hard for like, you know, Zoomers nowadays to even make sense of the whole thing. But sociologists and people studying, you know, the history of music and race and all this stuff have really done a number, like I've just obliterated Steve Dahl. And good. So, I mean, Thomas, you were like during the podcast and they have just torn up like, hey, and a lot of them will say too, like, I don't think Steve Dahl is racist. I don't think Steve Dahl is homophobic at all, but he is willing to like, to organize those people and point them in a direction that is...
That's the same. That's the same. It's like, the I'm not same. Trying to be performative exactly. or anything. That's just the course, same.
No. And like I said, Thomas, all of them say that too. Like, and so he has just been kind of like really like drug over the coals by the media and, you know, which I think is pretty justified for what ended up happening. So he released a book in like 2014, Disco Demolition Night, I think is what it was called. And it was him just... as a not a great writer, partnering with a slightly better writer to this book was not available for the library to even reserve for me. Like it wasn't even in their system. So it wasn't a popular book either,
wow.
But he was just good. Basically trying to defend his point of view. And so I will just read you this quote from him, from the book. He says, "When you see the images of Disco Demolition, it sure does look like a book burning, but it really wasn't that."
That's it.
Awesome.
Oh my god.
Cool. Like,
I know what so, it looks like.
Yeah. So yeah, Steve, he's been podcasting since the first pod was
cast.
Yeah,
that's he was built that's for fitting. It. I hate to say it.
I know.
As podcasters ourselves, but you know, lowest of the low.
Yeah, yeah. So I will end with this. So remember I mentioned that Usher, Vince Lawrence, earlier?
Yes.
So he actually did a really cool interview by NPR a few years back. So since then, Vince Lawrence has actually become a DJ, like a pretty popular one who has helped popularize in the, I think, the late 80s, early 90s, like what house music, like the
wow,
what has become so popular, yeah, you know, like EDM, wow, dance music, like and yes, you can look him up. He's on Spotify. He really like helped found kind of the Chicago electronic music scene. And so during that night, during the chaos way back in 79, Lawrence, you know, his teenager Usher, is looking through these piles of disco records. And some of them are really, really good. And some of them are like kind of rare. And so he kind of got the pick of the litter of just like picking through the albums nice. And like taking the ones he wanted. And so he kept some of the albums from the pile. And after all of the shenanigans were over, he took them home. And so, yeah, he goes on to become this huge part of the beginning of, like I said, what's now called house music. He's still a DJ in Chicago.
Nice.
And he still plays some of the records he saved from Disco Demolition Night.
Very good.
Oh, hell
isn't that
yeah.
awesome?
Okay, so yeah, we get to end on a little bit of like an up note.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah. So yeah, pretty cool story there. You know, and it just showed like he and that's all he talks about is like yeah. Disco never died. We just changed the name to dance music, and then we changed it to EDM, and then we changed it to house, and then yeah, we changed it to yeah. electronica. And then, you know, it's just, it's still alive and well, my friends. And disco never died. It's just in your heart now.
That's right. It's everywhere. It's all over the place. Yeah. I mean, the moral of the story here is if you're thinking about recommending your ex-husband for a job, do not, because you'll send them on a path. To then getting fired and then starting an incredible riot.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, definitely. Yeah. The real winner here was certainly whoever that woman was who very quickly and accurately realized that this guy was no good and dumped him as she should have. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the hinge point here. Is that lady, you know, calling in to ask for a Leonard Cohen song that caused Disco Demolition.
No. I'm not. She's not to blame for this. Leonard Cohen, not yeah. to blame for this. You know, very, very. She was in the right in both requesting Leonard Cohen and immediately dumping this guy after realizing he was no good.
Yeah. So yeah, that my friends, that is Disco Demolition Night. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. It was great.